Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is yours truly at the Hamburg Steinway here in Armstrong Auditorium, and I'm playing a jig by Johann Sebastian Bach from one of his keyboard suites, and it's an example of an Irish folk dance style finding its way into the standard fine art musical repertoire. The Irish and Scottish musical traditions have had a significant impact on the fine art music of Western civilization, and in this episode of Music for Life, we will explore the impact these Celtic cultures have had on music history. We have an absolutely fascinating Sounds of Scripture segment today, discussing the intriguing similarities between the culture of the Old Testament Hebrews and that of the Celts. For our Classroom Corner segment, we will explore a device used by the Irish minstrel bards that is also used in music education. And for our Backstage Banter, we talk with internationally acclaimed Oklahoma-based bagpiper Bruce Robertson about the anatomy of this instrument, as well as what every listener should know about the art of piping.
If it doesn't sound good, it's probably not being played properly, because an in-tune bagpipe, it gives you so much. It can be a really sweet instrument, even the Great Highland bagpipe.
Today on Music for Life, the Celtic influence. You may be familiar with the story of how negatively Handel's Messiah was initially received in England, but how its overwhelmingly positive reception in Dublin, Ireland was a strong contributing factor to this oratorio's early success. Ireland, and Scotland for that matter, are rich in musical tradition. But what's interesting about their artistic traditions is the impact that they have had on the larger output of the classical repertoire. The countries of Ireland and Scotland have greatly shaped the musical history of Western civilization. Folk dances from the Irish and Scottish traditions have commonly found themselves in well-known fine art compositions. The harp's inclusion into the standard instrumentation of mainland Europe was another result of Irish influence, which we will hear more about later. We will also see how an Irish composer impacted some of history's more famous composers. But before we get into the standard repertoire and see these influences in fine art music, let's begin today's discussion with our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. Today for this segment, we're going to explore something utterly fascinating. We will see some astounding cultural similarities between the Celtic culture and the biblical Hebrew culture. We will show documentation in the biblical record of why this is so. We can also extrapolate from these cultural connections some more specific educated guesses as to what the music of the ancient Hebrews was like based on what Celtic folk music is like. First, let's talk about how elements of Hebrew culture found their way into the Celtic Isles. This actually happened in stages. Around the time just after the Hebrew Exodus from Egypt, some of the Israelite tribe of Dan settled in Ireland. Later, during the life of King David, a specific branch of the tribe of Judah arrived in Ireland. Then, perhaps more controversial, is the stage where remnants of the Davidic dynasty arrived in Ireland just after Babylon's Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Judea, then under the rule of King Zedekiah. Though many believe the dynasty of David ceased with the slaughter of Zedekiah's sons, the biblical record clearly indicates that the king's daughters escaped with the prophet Jeremiah. This can be found in Jeremiah 41 verse 10 and Jeremiah 43 verse 6. Other biblical passages even give clues as to where Jeremiah and these daughters went. For those who rely on the Bible as 100% accurate, this is important, as this all fulfills a promise God made to David that his dynasty would never cease, that the royal line was carried on through the king's daughter and is still in existence today. That is the premise upon which Herbert Armstrong based his riveting and most requested book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Pairing this biblical evidence with secular history, Mr. Armstrong showed where Jeremiah and the king's daughters went. He writes, "In 569 BC, date of Jeremiah's transplanting, an elderly white-haired patriarch, sometimes referred to as a saint, came to Ireland. With him was the princess daughter of an eastern king and a companion called Simon Brach, spelled in different histories as Brech, Berech, Brach, or Berach. The princess had a Hebrew name, Tephi, a pet name, her full name being Tia Tephi. This royal party included the son of the king of Ireland who had been in Jerusalem at the time of the siege. There he had become acquainted with Tia Tephi. He married her shortly after 585 when the city fell. Their young son, now about 12 years of age, accompanied them to Ireland. Besides the royal family, Jeremiah brought with them some remarkable things, including a harp, an ark, and a wonderful stone called Liafail, or Stone of Destiny." And that's a quote from Herbert Armstrong's The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Consider one of those items that Jeremiah brought to Ireland, the harp. The harp is symbolic of a musical culture having accompanied this royal entourage, but it was also literally an instrument which was so pervasive in the Hebrew culture. Some legends suggest this was actually the harp of David himself and that it was buried with Tia Tephi on Tara Hill. This instrument, not only the national symbol of the Hebrews, today remains the national symbol of Ireland and its famous Guinness beer. The iconic harp in both Hebrew and Celtic cultures is just one of many strong similarities between the two cultures, and strong evidence attesting to the fact that Jeremiah and a Jewish princess transferred the royal culture into the Celtic Isles. It's not just that the harp appears on certain Irish flags or on a beer logo. Here's an intriguing link. Frank Whelan, in his book The Complete Guide to Irish Dance, lists ancient Irish instruments that accompanied this dance form, one of which is the kinnor, K-I-N-N-O-R. Kinnor is the Hebrew word for harp. Also, elsewhere in the British Isles, it's interesting to note that the harp was the most common household instrument in Wales until it was replaced by the piano. Most remarkable is this quote from Vincenzo de Galilei, the father of the famous Galileo Galilei, who noted in his Dialogo della Musica that Italy received the harp from Ireland. Now, it's not just interesting that that's documented in his writing, that Italy got the harp from Ireland. What's interesting is this quote of Galilei's. He says, "This most ancient instrument was brought to us, Italians, from Ireland, where such are most excellently worked, and in a great number, the inhabitants of the said island have made their art during the many centuries they have lived there, and moreover, it is a special undertaking of the kingdom, and they paint and engrave it in their public and private buildings and on their hill, stating, as their reason for doing so, that they have descended from the royal prophet David." That's a quote from a Renaissance giant, Vincenzo de Galilei. So the Irish, back in Galilei's time, even acknowledged their Davidic ancestry. They acknowledged their connection with the culture of biblical Israel. Let's notice some other similarities in the instruments being favored. Another instrument commonly referenced in the Hebrew Bible is denoted by the Hebrew word nebel, which we have shown in a previous episode was a precursor to the Celtic ullian pipes or the bagpipes. The Hebrew word literally means skin bag, or skin bottle, or it means to inflate or bulge, or something that collapses when empty. It is used in the context of having a roar in Isaiah 14:11, or a drone. Psalm 33:2 says it's capable of a loud noise, and Amos 6:5 refers to those who sing to the blowing of the nebel. The pipes used in both the Irish and Scottish culture use the inflation and deflation of air in a bag to support the sound. The Scottish Highland bagpipes use their mouths to blow. The ullian pipes, which are more associated with the Irish culture, require the arm to compress and decompress the bag at the performer's side. And the latter would allow for the references made in the Hebrew Bible to singing while playing the nebel. And if we follow this cultural connection between the Jews and Celts, this explanation for nebel is much more plausible. The Jewish historian Josephus said the nebel had 12 musical notes, which was played upon by the fingers. And interestingly, according to Fintan Vallely's Companion to Irish Traditional Music, the Irish mouth-blown bagpipes have a chanter with a ranger of 12 notes. So with the harp and the Ulian pipes, we have two instruments that show a strong cultural link between the Hebrew culture and the Celtic folk culture. One could even argue a similarity between the main percussion instrument of both cultures. The Bible references the taf a fair bit, a circular-framed drum, and this shares similarities with the Irish boron. Other musical similarities between the biblical Hebrews and the Celts can be found in the use of harmony. One of the most pleasing harmonies to the human ear, and one upon which the majority of standard Western repertoire is based, is the interval called the third. Standard chords are based on this interval. At the piano, if you play a white note and call that one, and then count up or down to three, and you play note one along with note three, that would be the interval of a third. There's an ancient English word used to describe the singing in harmony, particular notes that are a third away from the melody, the third referring to that musical spacing. The English word is gymel, G-Y-M-E-L. What's fascinating about this word is that this is also the name of the third letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and therefore it is the numeral in Hebrew for three or third. So there's both a harmonic and even linguistic link between these two cultures. In the 12th century AD, supposedly a time when harmony wasn't used in music, a man by the name of Giraldus Cambrensis, who traveled to Ireland in 1184, documented the use of harmony in Ireland as well as in Wales, North England, and Scotland. Describing music of Wales, his homeland, Cambrensis writes, "They, the Welsh, sing not uniformly as elsewhere, but in various ways and in many keys and tones, so that in a crowd of singers, which is their custom, you hear as many parts and different voices as you see heads, all closing with exquisite softness and blended together in one rich harmonious strain." Giraldus Cambrensis notes a similar usage of complex homophony and polyphony in Northern England. Of the music in both of these places, he writes, "Nor is it by art only, but by ancient use, and as if now converted into nature by constant habit, that the people of either of these countries have acquired this peculiar faculty, for so it has extended, and such deep root has it taken in each, that no melody is wont to be sung singly, but either in many parts, as among the former, or at least in two parts, as among the latter. And what is more extraordinary, the boys, and even those who are little more than infants, when they first begin to break out from cries into songs, adopt the same manner of singing." It should not be surprising to find, given how the musically rich Hebrew culture migrated into the British Isles, that rich, complex music is there. William Flood, in his History of Irish Music, quotes Sir Frederick Gore, who said that if you look at the construction of the Irish harp, one realizes that, quote, "harmony must have been known to the ancient Irish," unquote. Flood also wrote, here's another quote, "everywhere through the records we find evidences that the ancient Irish people, both high and low, were passionately fond of music. It entered into their daily life and formed part of their amusements, meetings, and celebrations of every kind." That's a quote from William Flood, History of Irish Music. For these people, passionately fond of music, it was not just used in worship, but in daily life. That quote reminds me of this quote that I've read before by Susan Eich Ventura, who said the Hebrews, being themselves born musicians, were impregnated by it. Born musicians, the Hebrews, she said, so similar to what William Flood said of the Irish. Another cultural connection between the biblical Hebrews and the Celts is found in the influential schools of Ireland. Just like ancient Israel, Ireland was known for its institutions of higher learning. Ireland's schools had a large influence on the rest of Europe and contained a curriculum that put strong emphasis on the arts. The Irish traced the strong tradition of their scholastic institutions back to a leader known as Olaf Fola. There is strong evidence that this man and the prophet Jeremiah are one and the same. We know Jeremiah would have placed a huge emphasis on music in his schools. After all, he thought to take a royal harp with him, along with the coronation stone and the Ark of the Covenant. One of the most important functions of these Irish universities was the training of musicians in Ireland. These ancient Celtic poet-musicians were known as bards. They were vital advisors to the king, perhaps more like the prophets or seers of the Davidic kings mentioned in the Old Testament, Gad, Nathan, Haman, Asaph, Yeduthun. It's not hard to understand how music was so intrinsically tied to the Irish throne, if we understand that this, in fact, was the throne of David, the sweet psalmist of Israel. William Flood's history reads, "In ancient Ireland, the systems of law, medicine, poetry, and music, according to Keating, were set to music, being poetical compositions." Valancey tells us that the bards, specially selected from amongst noble youths of conspicuous stature and beauty, had a distinctive dress of five colors and wore a white mantle and a blue cap ornamented with a gold crescent. The curriculum for an ola, or bard, extended to 12 years and more, at the expiration of which he was given the doctor's cap, that is, the bard, and the title of ola. That is why the king could go to them. They were knowledgeable. They had all this history and understanding memorized in the form of songs. We'll mention that in our classroom corner, how they memorized all this history by using music. According to J.H. Allen, in Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, the word ola is Hebrew for revealer of hidden knowledge or prophet. That word ola is spelled O-L-L-A-M-H. So there is even yet another linguistic connection. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister from 1874 to 1880, wrote, "To whose harp do the people of England fly for sympathy and solace? Who is the most popular poet in this country? Is he to be found among the Mr. Wordsworths and the Lord Byrons, amid sauntering reveries or monologues of sublime satiety? Shall we seek him among the wits of Queen Anne? Even to the myriad-minded Shakespeare can we award the palm. No. The most popular poet in England is the sweet singer of Israel. Since the days of the heritage, when every man dwelt safely under his vine and under his fig tree, there never was a race who sang so often the odes of David as the people of Great Britain. Vast as the obligations of the whole human family are to the Hebrew race, there is no portion of the modern population so much indebted to them as the British people. It was the sword of the Lord and of Gideon that won the boasted liberties of England. Chanting the same canticles that cheered the heart of Judah amid their glens, the Scotch, upon their hillsides, achieved their religious freedom." That was a quote from Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister from 1874 to 1880. Some have even wondered if the cultural connection between the Celts and the biblical Hebrews goes back even to the days of Joseph, wondering if the coat of many colors described in Genesis 37:3 would have closely resembled the tartan plaids of the various Celtic tribes. Let's briefly explore just one more cultural connection between these two cultures, that of dance. When you consider the similarities so far, it shouldn't surprise us to see the same in this artistic medium. In fact, in the record of King David dancing before the Ark of the Covenant, there are some interesting similarities between the art form of Irish dance and the Hebrew words used to describe what David was doing. 1 Chronicles 15:29 says that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out a window and saw David dancing and playing. The Hebrew word for dancing is not the typical Hebrew word usually used to describe this art form in the Old Testament. It more commonly refers either to children dancing or the skipping or springing of animals. The parallel account in 2 Samuel 6:14-16 says David was leaping and dancing. There is another unique Hebrew word for dancing, meaning whirling. It is used only here to describe David, along with the word for leaping, which means to be light, agile, and to jump as a gazelle. Perhaps this is the first Highland fling or a dance of its kind to favor the kicking, jumping, skipping-like motions that caught on and eventually found deep cultural roots in the Celtic lands where the throne of David would later migrate. This has been Sounds of Scripture. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's show is called The Celtic Influence, and we are exploring the impact of the Irish and Scottish musical and dance traditions on standard music history. Now, when I say Celtic, I'm talking mainly of the Irish and or Scottish cultures. Those cultures, as different as they are today, actually have a closer connection far back in history. In the days of the Roman Empire, the island of Ireland was called Scotia, and its people were referred to as the Scots. What is known as Scotland today was then a region referred to as Alba. After the Irish royals, technically what we call the Scots, started colonizing the western part of Alba, what we call Scotland today, they met resistance from the region's native Picts, P-I-C-T-S. This transition of what we'd call Irish over to Scotland started with the efforts of Fergus the Great, who took the Stone of Destiny from Scotia to Alba, or Ireland to Scotland in modern terminology. Ultimately, the Alba side of that kingdom broke away from what we call Ireland, and by the 9th century AD, King Kenneth MacAlpin conquered the Picts and united the entire kingdom of Alba, uniting Scots, descendants of those from Ireland, and Picts. So the very name Scotland evokes this history of its connection back to Ireland, once called essentially the land of the Scots. So I just give that to justify my generally broad brush when I paint things Celtic as those of Irish and or Scottish culture. In terms of standard music history, let's start with the Baroque era, roughly the mid-17th to mid-18th centuries. At the top of this episode, I was using a Baroque jig from Bach's French Suite in G major, the final movements of most suites and partitas at the time, whether they were called English suites, French suites, or any other kind of suite or partita for that matter, were almost always jigs. A jig is a lively Irish dance with a duple compound meter, meaning musically that there are two or four beats per bar, but that the beat is divided into three subdivisions each. Musicians would read that as 6/8 time, or perhaps 12/8 time. We talked about the 6/8 time signature on a previous episode of Music for Life, where there are 6/8 notes per bar, and there is a stress on the first and fourth eighth notes, giving it a 2-beat per bar feel, with each beat, again, being divided into three parts. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So let's listen to another jig from a Bach suite. This is the jig from the famous Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. You probably know the prelude from this cello suite. Everyone does. But here's the jig, the sixth and final movement, performed here by German cellist Tess Remy Schumacher, currently based right here in Edmond, Oklahoma. So that was the final movement, the jig movement, from J.S. Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G, performed by cellist Tess Remy Schumacher. Another way the Celtic influence was seen in the music of the Baroque era was through the use of an instrument known as a musette. The musette was an instrument of the bagpipe family. Some composers wrote pieces for the musette, but probably it's most commonly known because J.S. Bach wrote a few keyboard pieces titled musette. What's interesting about these pieces is that they contain a left-hand accompaniment that has a singular note either held or repeated underneath the right-hand melody. This, of course, emulates the drone effect of the bagpipe, the drones being the sustaining pitches that underpin the melody of the bagpipes. This is quite evident in this musette that nearly all my young piano students will play when first starting on the piano. You'll hear the left hand repeating the same notes over long stretches, representing these drone pitches. So I'll play this short little musette in D by J.S. Bach now. ¶¶ So that was Johann Sebastian Bach's Musette in D, performed there on my home piano. A musette was an instrument of the bagpipe family, and today on Music for Life, we are exploring the Celtic influence in the standard history of fine art music. In the Baroque era, composers were writing music for the musette or writing keyboard pieces intended to emulate or honor this instrument. Before that, we talked about how composers composed jigs after the Irish dance style in their suites, usually as a final movement of those suites. Another dance common to the British Isles at this time, and one employed a lot in the Irish dance community, is the hornpipe. And composers of the Baroque era, in addition to writing jigs, were writing hornpipe movements in their suites as well. This is commonly a duple meter dance in a lively, upbeat tempo. But there were other forms of this dance that had a triple meter beat pattern. This is the case in the most famous hornpipes of the Baroque era's music. These hornpipes are those composed by George Frideric Handel in his Water Music Suites. I'll play both of these. The first one is from the Water Music Suite No. 1. It isn't as famous as the one from No. 2, but they're short, and you can hear the strong folk dance influence in these movements. So that was the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra performing the hornpipe movement of G.F. Handel's Water Music Suite No. 1. Now let's hear the hornpipe from the Water Music Suite No. 2. This is the more well-known of the two. Thank you. That was the A la Hornpipe movement of Water Music Suite No. 2 by G.F. Handel, and it was an example of a dance tradition or dance style from the Celtic culture, that of a hornpipe, being employed in compositions of Western civilization. Again, that was the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Moving into the classical era, the hornpipe was a nickname attached to one of Franz Josef Haydn's string quartets, particularly because of its brisk folk dance-like quality of the final movement. It's a very short final movement, and the violin one plays in what we call a perpetual motion, a fast assortment of pitches that never seems to pause throughout the entire movement. Listen to this, and maybe you could envision a Celtic fiddler doing something similar to this in this hornpipe movement of Haydn String Quartet in D, Opus 64, No. 5. Here it is performed by the Jerusalem String Quartet. That was a string quartet, two violins, a viola, and a cello, performing Franz Josef Haydn's String Quartet in D, Opus 64, No. 5. Because of that movement's resemblance to a folk dance of the British Isles, the hornpipe, that movement received the nickname the Hornpipe Movement. Now, I should mention that if you're looking for that quartet, it has two nicknames. It was also nicknamed the Lark, due to the lark-like quality of the violin melody in the first movement. We saw hornpipes being incorporated into Baroque compositions by composers such as G.F. Handel. We also discussed in the Baroque era composers who incorporated the jig, an Irish dance style, into their suites. In the classical era, composers were still keen on writing music in the lively, lilting meter of the jig. Sometimes they called their work a jig, as in the case of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's Jig in G Major. Here's a recording of it performed by Alexander Lonkvik. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's show is called The Celtic Influence, and we are exploring the impact that the Irish and Scottish musical and dance traditions have had on standard music history. That was Mozart's jig in G major, performed by pianist Alexander Lundqvist. A jig is a lively dance from the British Isles, associated mainly with the Irish and Scottish cultures. Another dance from this area that found its way into the music of the classical era was the écossaise. The word écossaise is French for Scottish, and it refers to a peppy Scottish folk dance. Piano students may be familiar with these six écossaises attributed to Beethoven. This is pianist Alfred Brendel playing these six écossaises as one continuous work without interruption, which helps the listener identify how each dance ends with the same refrain or chorus of sorts. So those were Beethoven's six écossaises. Écossaise is French for Scottish, and it represented a lively Scottish folk dance popular on the European mainland in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Moving into the Romantic era, one of its most famous composers for the piano wrote some charming écossaises. Here is Vladimir Ashkenazy performing this short set of Frédéric Chopin's three écossaises. Each has a short pause in between, but in total they take just over 2 minutes to perform all three. Thank you. That was Frédéric Chopin's Three Écossaises, performed by pianist Vladimir Ashkenazy. Again, an écossaise is a lively Scottish folk dance popular on the European mainland in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And today on Music for Life, we are studying this Celtic influence in classical music. The culture of Scotland had a significant impact on Western composers. Beethoven, Schubert, and Chopin all wrote écossaises for the piano. We heard some of Beethoven's and Chopin's. So you can imagine the impact this country would have on a major composer who visited there for a substantial period of time. In the summer of 1829, a 20-year-old Felix Mendelssohn took a three-week visit to Scotland, a trip that inspired his Symphony No. 3, known as the Scottish Symphony. Mendelssohn's parents wanted him to take a grand tour of Europe, but rather than suggest a more typical destination like France or Italy, they wanted him to travel to Scotland first. One of the reasons was because Sir Walter Scott, a very popular writer at the time, attributed a lot of the inspiration of his novels to the Scottish land. They hoped their son would derive some musical inspiration there. And because Mendelssohn wrote letters to his parents detailing his experience, historians can easily follow his footsteps through Scotland. On Thursday, July 30th, 1829, while visiting Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh, Mendelssohn was inspired to write the introduction to his famous Scottish Symphony. That day, Mendelssohn wrote of his experience. "In the evening twilight, we went today to the palace where Queen Mary lived and loved. The chapel close to it is now roofless, grass and ivy grow there, and at that broken altar Mary was crowned Queen of Scotland. Everything around is broken and moldering, and the bright sky shines in. I believe I found today in that old chapel the beginning of my Scottish symphony." And here's a little of that introduction. Though inspired to write the symphony's introduction at this time, Mendelssohn did not complete the work until 1842, 13 years after his trip to Scotland. Though it is listed as Symphony No. 3, this was actually his last symphony out of the five to complete. While Mendelssohn derived inspiration from his experience at Holyrood, he does little to indicate that any other part of his symphony was inspired by specific moments in that Scottish trip. Now, he doesn't quote any famous Scottish folk tunes in his symphony either, but still, you can hear clear influences of Scottish folk music in the lilting dance tempo of the first movement after the introduction is finished. Though lilting, this movement is still quite somber melodically, which makes for an interesting blend of a folk dance rhythm and a brooding romantic German spirit. Let's hear a little of that. The lively tempo and dotted rhythms of the second movement are a more direct musical homage to the Scottish culture. Let's hear this short movement. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's show is titled The Celtic Influence, and we are exploring the impact that the Irish and Scottish musical and dance traditions have had on standard music history. We are exploring Felix Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony, a work inspired by the composer's trip to that area. That was the lively second movement, what one might call the dance movement of that symphony. The dance movement of symphonies were usually third movements, but by this point in history, thanks to Beethoven, composers sometimes put the lilting dance movements second instead of third in movement order. We are listening to a recording of the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Claudio Abbado. To give you more of the Scottish flavor of the rhythms and harmonies of the symphony, I want to play you the beginning and the end of the fourth and final movement. The beginning is marked vivacissimo, meaning very brisk in tempo. You'll hear more of the sprightly dotted rhythms commonly heard in Scottish folk music, even though Mendelssohn never quotes an actual Scottish folk melody. So that was the vivacissimo opening of the final movement of Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony. Here's the ending, what's called the coda, literally meaning in Italian, the tail of the piece. The coda is marked maestoso, or majestic. This implies a broader tempo, but I think you can gather a sense of the Scottish folk influences on the sound Mendelssohn gets from the orchestra. So today on Music for Life, we are discussing the Celtic influence, that is, the impact of the Irish and Scottish musical and dance traditions on major composers of history. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Chopin and an Irish composer who had a significant impact on Chopin's output. We will also have both our Classroom Corner and our Backstage Banter segments where we talk about the beauty of the bagpipe with Bruce Robertson. So stick around, we'll be right back.